This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Early figures on the number of deaths during last week's heatwave in southeastern Australia suggest it was responsible for hundreds of deaths.
A five-day record-breaking heatwave has left the southeast of Australia sweltering. Scorching temperatures as high as 46 degrees Celsius have been forecast for the next few days too, putting emergency services on high alert. Yesterday in South Australia, more than 26,000 lightning strikes were recorded, sparking dozens of blazes that are still raging today. In major cities, people are being told to brace for blackouts as the sustained use of air conditioners puts a strain on power companies. In most places overnight, the temperature isn't likely to drop much below 30 degrees Celsius.
I just spoke to the Weather Bureau a short time ago and they've confirmed that Adelaide is the hottest city in the world today. So what a title to have. It just doesn't get any easier. This is the fourth day we've had out of a five expected days over 40 degrees. Now that's the third worst heat wave on record. And as you said, it's tipped to get to 46 degrees later in the day today. It's already 40 degrees and it's so hot. And it, around most of the state, they're experiencing these sorts of temperatures. In fact, even hotter in some centres. There's 47 degrees expected in Port Augusta, Renmark and Murray Bridge. And in fact, the very coolest place to be today in South Australia is Robe in the state's southeast. And perhaps what's even worse is some of the overnight temperatures that South Australians have been facing. For instance, at 1 a.m. this morning, it was still 35 degrees. So a very restless night for many South Australians.
Chris Fawkes from BBC Weather has the details for us now. Chris, what have you been finding?
Well, John, yes, according to the World Meteorological Organization, 2013 was the sixth hottest in history. That's equaled 2007. Compared with average temperatures between 1961 and 1990, last year the temperature of the air and land was about half a degree Celsius warmer. It was the hottest year ever in Australia, and the United States hit a record in June with 53.9 Celsius in where else but Death Valley. At the opposite end of the scale in July, satellite analysis of the atmosphere in Antarctica registered minus 93 Celsius, the second coldest temperature ever recorded. Are we looking at a period of extreme weather, and is the changing climate responsible for this?
If you look at all the events that we've seen over the last 12 months, many of them actually fit with what we would expect from climate change. However, some of them will be just that natural variability in weather that we see. However, because of the number, because of the frequency, these are not random rare events now. These are common events. So we are breaking the world records for heat waves, for hurricane strength, for flood duration every single year.
It Is global warming the right title to give it? Because what we seem to be describing is not where everything's getting warmer. Sometimes it's far colder, it's far windier, it's far wetter, it's far hotter. And just every extreme seems to be more polarised somehow.
It's a fantastic point. Really hit the nail on the head. It's a global phenomenon. So we've got people on Twitter in North America saying global warming, pah, because they're having a cold year. But this could be related, actually, to global warming. It's certainly related to our weather pattern here in the United Kingdom. We're having incredibly wet, probably one of the wettest winters we've ever seen. Very, very windy. So how is it related? Well, the global climate system isn't heating up at a uniform rate. The poles are heating up much faster than the equator, for example. And when we look at the weather patterns, the jet stream is powered by temperature contrasts. So if the contrast between the tropics and the poles are getting less because of this uneven distribution of heating of the Earth's atmosphere, then what might happen is the jet stream might slow. If that happens, we get a longer wave pattern like this. The whole jet stream becomes much slower moving. Or in other words, you can get weather patterns stuck for a number of months. Does that sound familiar? North America getting the cold weather. We've had a couple of months solidly of rain now. So this could be actually partly related to climate change.
Can scientists finally say this extreme weather event, this storm, that flood was caused by climate change? Not so fast. Nothing simple about the way the Earth works. The planet's top weather agency, the World Meteorological Organization, set up a special branch that partly looks into this. Dr. Thomas C. Peterson is president of the WMO Commission for Climatology. He's also the principal scientist for the National Climatic Data Center at NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, in Asheville, North Carolina. Dr. Peterson, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, for the past 2 years, you've helped gather up scientists to examine the links between human influences on the climate and the extreme weather events that dominate the news and millions of lives. Can you give us a snapshot of how these studies work?
Yes, I'd be happy to. One of the reasons we created this, it's now an annual supplement, is to foster the growth of the science. Attribution, event attribution science is a real difficult, you know, kind of cutting edge of our field. Several years ago, we used to say that you can't attribute any single event to climate change or to global warming. And about the time that we got politicians and journalists repeating our mantra that you can't attribute any event to global warming, the science had moved on. So you can, if you look at it in a probabilistic sense. You know, for example, a good analogy is the one of a baseball player who starts taking steroids and then hits 20% more home runs. And if you caught one of his home runs when he was on steroids, you wouldn't know whether that home run was caused by steroids or whether it was one he would have hit, you know, anyway, even if he hadn't taken steroids. But you can say that it was 20% more likely that you caught it because of the steroids. And the same is true with event attribution, where we're looking at individual events and seeing how they're changing and what kind of how climate change has either made them more common or less common or no effect on it at all. And there's lots of different techniques involved in this, and it's really an exciting field to be in because there's so many different ideas coming out there and so many different approaches that last year we had 19 different author groups producing analyses, and it was just really exciting to see the different approaches coming in, particularly when they looked at the same event. They generally came out with fairly similar results, but the different events kind of highlighted what we call structural uncertainty, how you look at it, you know, that how the uncertainty is. So that two different groups looking at it, you don't say, well, in a previous issue, one of the results said it, one event was 62 times more likely to occur now than in pre-industrial times. And now with two, you know, you get a sense of the potential errors associated with that estimate of 62.
Well, 2012, the most recent report, it was a big year for really big weather news. And before we go into some detail, can you just list some of the events that scientists examined for climate change fingerprints?
So we had examination of the drought in the central U.S., examination of the heat wave in the eastern U.S., Hurricane Sandy, a really remarkable drop in summertime Arctic sea ice. We looked at heavy rains in northern Europe and drought in the Iberian Peninsula, you know, Spain and Portugal region. We also had a really interesting little event that looked at a cold outbreak in Holland that seemed to be cold enough that they could run this 11-city ice skating race made famous in the, you know, Hans Brinker and the Silver Skates. But they couldn't do it this year, and the question was, did it not get cold enough, or was there something else causing it, or was this climate change? Another examination of a drought in the Horn of Africa, which is, you know, Ethiopia and Somalia and parts of Kenya. Heavy rainfall events in northern China and heavy rainfall events in southern Japan. We also had a heavy rainfall event in New Zealand and two different studies examining heavy rainfall in Australia.
Well, as you noted in the report, scientists picked stories close to their own countries or regions, and I know my listeners will do the same. So I'd like to select extreme weather case studies from the United States, from the United Kingdom, and from Australia before we get to the giant global issue of disappearing Arctic sea ice. So why don't we start with Hurricane Sandy? It was a multi-billion-dollar disaster hitting New York and New England in October 2012. Can we say climate change contributed to that storm and the damage?
We can definitely say that climate change contributed to the damage that Hurricane Sandy caused. After Sandy hit, we scoured the scientific community, contacting lots of potential people who might work on analysis of attribution of Sandy. And most of the people we contacted either said that they weren't going to be working on it, or that, you know, because it was just too complex, or sure, we'd love to do one, but our results won't be available for 3 years. But we did find one group that isolated one aspect of it, and that's sea level rise, how, you know, the global warming is causing the seas to rise through the melting of glaciers, melting of ice mass on Greenland, and also through the warming of the water because, you know, as things warm, they expand. So the water's expanding as it, the ocean water is expanding as it's warming. And what impact that has made on the change in the probability of having an event like Sandy, inundation like Sandy. It turns out that the sea level rise is only a minor part of the Hurricane Sandy event, but that little minor part, when you're looking way at the tail of the distribution of such a rare event, can change whether Hurricane Sandy is a 1,500-year return period or a 200-year return period event. And then we get into what does it imply for the future as sea level continues to rise, and it could become a much more common event, you know, like a 100 or even a 50-year event as sea level continues to rise. And this is the kind of information that I think is real helpful for people when they're rebuilding. They need to know, I mean, if this was a 1,000-year event and you're not expecting it to come back again for another 1,000 years, or I have a probability of not returning for 1,000 years, then you might rebuild along the coast just the same way you had before. But if you can see clear information that shows that these kind of events are becoming more likely and that high inundation levels are likely to occur again and more frequently, then you realize that, well, when you know, if you rebuild your house, you build it up on stilts, you build it higher, you do something different so that you're not as vulnerable as you were before.
Dr. Peterson, let's look at another extreme happening in America that same year, and I'm talking about the 2012 drought that hit the U.S. central states in the east. How bad was it?
Oh, the drought was really serious for the people involved in it. It had a lot of hardship for the farmers and the individuals involved. And the study that examined it was a really interesting study in that what they did was they took sea surface temperature patterns that we have. They took the actual sea surface temperature and ran a model on it and saw whether we would get a drought or not. And then they took the sea surface temperature patterns and kept the patterns, but they cooled the sea surface temperature down to pre-industrial times. And they used a climate model that also had pre-industrial levels of CO2, and they ran the two models out. But when you're looking at changes in the far distribution of the tail, you need to run a model out hundreds and hundreds of times to get a reliable estimate of some of the extreme events that might occur. And the resources in this group was not available to own a supercomputer. So what they did was it was citizen scientist participation. They have this model that is now simplified enough that it can run on a home personal computer, and they have volunteers around the world who allow them to run their model on their computer at night when they're not using it. And then when the model is finished, it sends in results. So they had hundreds and hundreds of model results from this to compare from the model using the observed sea surface temperature and including the patterns in the temperature and the observed carbon dioxide and the pre-industrial levels of carbon dioxide and pre-industrial temperatures, but with the sea surface temperature pattern. And what they found was that the drought was just as likely, or almost just as likely, within the pre-industrial conditions as the current conditions. So their conclusion was that this drought was not enhanced by global warming, but it was a function of the sea surface temperature patterns helping produce circulation patterns that fueled the drought in the central U.S. And that also then is relevant for farmers who are planning and who need to know that, you know, is a drought like this likely to happen again next year? Is it likely to become worse? And this particular event, this particular analysis said no, that it wasn't.
Let's move across the pond, as they say in Britain. In 2012, the UK and much of Northern Europe experienced a drenching wet summer, even while Spain dried up and burned. What did teams of scientists conclude about the climate and the wet European summer of 2012?
This was interesting because we had several groups looking at it in several different approaches. And one of the approaches looked at this particular condition using global ocean temperatures and how they impact the circulation. And then they would substitute in climatology. So they substituted in climatology for the world ocean except the North Atlantic, and then the world ocean except the climatology for most of the Atlantic Ocean, but just not the region close to Europe. And what they found was that this event is very heavily dependent on the actual sea surface temperatures up in the far northern Atlantic Ocean. The Atlantic Ocean was really warm at the time, but they did not do the additional step further along to analyze and determine what caused the North Atlantic to be so warm. But what they did it were able to attribute was that the rainfall was directly related to the very warm ocean temperatures in the far North Atlantic, which then also has potential to help for forecasting and seasonal forecasts. If sea surface temperature patterns set up again like that, you can expect, you know, more heavy rainfall in parts of Northern Europe.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. We're talking about the growing trend of extreme weather events with one of the world's leading specialists, Dr. Thomas Peterson, from the World Meteorological Organization and the American agency NOAA. Well, as you know, Thomas Peterson, scientists don't always agree. One paper asked a question on many minds, namely, are recent wet northwestern European summers a response to sea ice retreat? And that group, led by scientist F.B. Simon, said there was no evidence the Arctic meltback affected the summer rains. And I thought to myself, well, that kind of contradicts studies of jet stream changes in sea ice done by Dr. Jennifer Francis of Rutgers. What's going on there?
It is interesting, the changes in the sea ice. They've been remarkable in the Arctic. And one of the things that happens when you have an ocean covered with ice, that it prevents a lot of heat from the ocean being released into the atmosphere. And when you remove that ice, the water will evaporate. And, you know, the moisture in the air is what fuels storms and stuff. So you have a potential to alter circulation around the world when you have another heat source in it. Indeed, you know, part of El Nino is when you get this warm water in the eastern tropical Pacific Ocean, and that releases a lot of heat into the atmosphere from that area, and it affects circulation patterns. So one of the things that's clear is that when you have a change in where the source of energy is coming in parts of the atmosphere, that you will get different results, different weather patterns forming. And different scientists and analysis show that different types of events. Depends on the type of rigor and the analysis of a particular event or whether it shows if you open up the Arctic Ocean in different times of year, you know, how that'll impact circulation in different ways.
It seems like the authors of the various papers on the Arctic sea ice had difficulty saying that the September low of 2012, which was an absolute record low, was about half of what we would have expected in previous decades, that it was caused by climate change in particular. Why are they having those doubts about what seems quite obvious to the rest of us?
So in the beginning of attribution of climate change, we had detection and attribution. Could you detect a change? And the first big change people looked at was global temperature average. Global average temperature was warming. You could detect a significant change in that. And then could you attribute it to warming? And the answer was yes. And then you started doing that on other things, like heavy precipitation in general, heavier precipitation during the days. And people have worked on Arctic sea ice, so we see this decrease in Arctic sea ice, and can you attribute that to climate change? And the answer is yes. But when you get to an individual year, you have other factors going in. Why was this year below the trend line? Or in this case, it was 2012 below the trend line, and 2013 was actually above the trend line. So why did it drop down so much, there were several different reasons involved. One was the general warming of the Arctic. One was that so much melting has occurred in past years that the ice was thinner, because two-year ice is about twice as thick as ice that only formed in one winter. And another factor was that in 2012, there was one particular storm that really churned up and broke up a lot of sea ice in a very short time, and it was a very powerful storm over the sea ice edge. So you have to factor all of those in to get a determinant of what you can say the causes were of this particular event being below the trend line. But you can still understand that the trend line is due to long-term warming.
2012 was also a tumultuous year for Australia. Like many other parts of the world, there were extreme precipitation events in the northern part of that country with floods and high cost to the economy and human lives. Was that an example of climate change?
That is what I think most people expected when they were starting to analyze it. And one of the model results shows that with climate change, Australia should expect to have some heavier precipitation events. And by heavier, they're talking like perhaps a 10 to 15% increase in the heavy rainfall events. But the rainfall that occurred then was so extreme and so far beyond above the 10 or 15% that the two analyses that were looked at it determined that, no, it was not a climate change of caused by climate change. It was caused by sea surface temperature patterns and the circulation involved in that. That, you know, we know that when we get an El Nino event and there's warming in the eastern tropical Pacific, Southern California gets heavier rainfall events. Well, when you get warming in the Pacific Ocean, you get less rainfall in Australia. The rain goes somewhere. The circulation changes. And there's been a lot of strong La Niñas lately and a lot of energy in the water off the coast of Australia in various areas. And it was determined by those two events that it was not long-term climate change that caused the heavy precipitation. Interesting, this last year in Australia was record warm year for Australia. And one of the groups that analyzed the heavy precipitation last year and concluded that it was not due to global warming is analyzing the temperature this year to see what can be concluded by that. And I expect that they will have different results, but we shall have to wait to see for sure until next year's report is released in September of 2014.
It seems to me from reading the papers, Dr. Peterson, that several scientists felt frustrated by climate models not reflecting what they knew was happening on the ground. For example, the Chinese scientists studying very extreme rains and flooding in northern China in 2012 said they couldn't assign the role of climate change due to problems with the CMIP5 climate models that when they were applied to that region. Do we still have this limitation of trying to peer through things with regional modeling?
We still have a lot of limitations, and there are lots of different models available that people are using. And the scientists working on them, you know, have different areas of focus that they work on. And some of the models have biases relative to other models. So, for example, I've heard that the Canadian model tends to dry the central part of continents more than some of the other models. So when you look at a model, you first want to make sure that that particular model does a good job in your area. And it's, you know, it should not be surprising that, for example, the UK Met Office model does an excellent job of simulating the climate of the UK. And so first want to make sure the model can reproduce the climate of your area before you try to find out how it can alter whether the climate is changing enough. And China also has been having some really interesting and dynamic changes in their climate, both in terms of the events of the previous year, but also in terms of the influx of atmospheric pollution from China and trying to understand how much of that is causing, you know, what problems and how you can pull out the different signals and stuff. And so it's a difficult challenge to understand fully.
Right. The industrial smog, a lot of particulates in the atmosphere, that could change things too. I want to ask you, who is paying close attention to the extreme weather reports of the American Meteorological Society and conferences like the one held in Oxford University in September of 2012? What sort of people are really focusing in on this?
One of the most interesting groups of people, there were a couple people at the meeting in Oxford from the reinsurance industry. So when you get insurance, say from State Farm or something like that, you know, from your local insurance agent in Florida, those insurance companies often hedge their bets by getting reinsurance, insurance upon that insurance, so that they won't be devastated if a hurricane hits their area. They will have the resources to cover that. So the reinsurance industry is really, really keenly interested in understanding how extreme events are changing. And how extreme events are changing is going to impact, you know, what they charge, because they're looking at competitive, because they're different companies, so they each are trying to get the best information they can, because they don't want to overcharge or they'll lose business, but they don't want to undercharge or they'll lose a lot of money when extreme events happen. And one of the interesting things is when we talk about attribution to extreme events, how things change, a lot of the way people change their behavior is actually the insurance company is leading the way on that, that, you know, you're not going to build your house unless you're independently wealthy. You're not going to build your house in a low-lying coastal area that an insurance company is going to refuse to provide insurance for. You're not going to be able to get a mortgage if the insurance company won't insure in your area. So insurance companies actually have a lot of influence on future building and construction and how people are decreasing the vulnerability to extreme events.
Thomas, in the wrap-up for the report you helped edit, there's an example of driving too fast as a parable for trying to measure climate risks with our science. Talk to us about that.
Okay, I'd be happy to. So this analogy is one that we borrowed from UCAR out in Boulder. And they have an analogy that, as we know, that if you increase the speed of your commute, that you're more likely to get into an accident. But when you do get into an accident, it often isn't because you were going 5 miles faster. It was because there was a texting driver next to you on a slick road who swerved into your lane or something like that. Now, if you were driving a little bit slower, you might have been able to avoid it. But the actual cause of the accident might be the texting driver. And that analogy works well in climate change, that, and we're looking at an event attribution, that we know that adding CO2 to the atmosphere, some people refer to as kind of the steroids of the atmosphere, that there's more energy, more potential for some extreme events to occur. That's like a driver going a little bit faster. But when an event actually does occur, there's so many other factors going in that you have to understand in order to cause it. Was it, how much of it was due to that, the texting driver, and how much of it was due to your faster speed? And that gives you a sense of the challenge that the scientists face in trying to understand this for individual extreme events. And one of the exciting things we have, looking forward to next, to the edition that will be coming out looking at 2013, is we have a large number of scientists, an increasing number of scientists, interested in giving us analyses of extreme events. And so the growth of this area of science is increasing.
Dr. Peterson, I really appreciate your work, and especially giving up your valuable time to talk with us. And I hope you persist for many years until the science does really grasp and be able to tell us what's coming up. Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith, and I've been talking with one of the world's top experts on extreme weather events, Dr. Thomas C. Peterson. He's the principal scientist at NOAA, and he's also the president of the World Meteorological Commission for Climatology. This is Radio EcoShock. Coming up, we'll head over to permaculture with Jonathan Bates. He's part of a duo growing tons of good food on a tiny city lot in the northern climate of Massachusetts. Before we go to our New England permaculture guest, let's hear rocker Neil Young. This song, Mother Earth, was performed live in December 2013 as part of the Honor the Treaty Tour, which highlighted severe problems with the Canadian tar sands and Aboriginal people. Find a link to the video version of this performance in my show blog at ecoshock.info. By the way, music is going to play a greater role in Radio EcoShock, speaking to the heart instead of just the brain. If you are getting this program as a lo-fi podcast, why not switch to the CD quality podcast instead? Just go to ecoshock.net, that's ecoshock.net, and click the podcast link that you'll find there. You will get the full sound package free, as always. Here's Neil Young.
It's a little hymn here for the Canadians. A hymn for Canada.
Our children. Children's Day.
That was Neil Young with a live performance from his anti-tar sand song, Mother Earth.
Radio EcoShock.
Chances are you are not living on an ideal homestead of 20 acres, ready to feed yourself and your family come what may. But what if you're on a normal city lot and maybe even in a northern climate? What can you do? It turns out quite a bit. We're going to visit with Jonathan Bates, with fellow permaculturist Eric Toinsmeyer. Jonathan has turned his 1/10 of an acre yard in Holyoke, Massachusetts, into what they call Paradise Lot. That's the title of Eric's best-selling homestead book, telling you what works and what doesn't. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Yeah, it's wonderful to be here. Thanks for calling.
How did it start, and what did you start with?
Well, good question. Depends on how far back you want to go. But I've been kind of involved with environmental activism and interested in kind of green and ecological movements for probably over 20 years at this point. In the last 10 years or so, I've kind of focused my attention on the home economic end of things and community activism. And particularly, I like to do a lot of my work through what's called permaculture. In the last 13 years, Eric and I have been gardening together. And the last 10 years, he and I and our two families have been gardening with permaculture techniques in Holyoke, Massachusetts.
And what was the yard like when you first got there? Was it all set up as a garden?
No, not at all. You know, many of your listeners out there might have an image of a typical urban street where, 100-year-old houses sit 15 feet apart or so, and on a very small acreage, in this case, 1/10 of an acre. And when we got here, the house that was previously here had burned down. So it was an empty lot for many years, and the builder decided to build a smaller duplex. So the lot that we arrived to and saw was pretty denuded. It was covered in weeds, no trees, and most of the topsoil was either polluted or scraped off and replaced limited material. In case of the old house, part of the yard actually was filled in with asphalt and concrete. We were really working on a landscape that was pretty poor.
Why did you decide to go with permaculture instead of the traditional row gardens found in most backyards?
Well, both my and Eric's interest in permaculture comes from a place of holistic thinking. And even though we both support and have worked on and with organic farmers for many years and the importance of eating healthy food and healthy vegetables, we felt like to be have a more long-term stay and improvement in the system, perennial systems, perennial plants are the best way to go. That is, it's a lower maintenance, so there's no tillage or very little tillage. You're investing in the long term, so you're planting with the idea that over time the yield will increase because the trees and shrubs and herbs continue to grow and get bigger each year, or at least we'll have a larger crop later on. Rather than having to spend money every year to buy seeds and the time and effort it takes to grow them out and then tillage every year, or depending on having to save your own seeds, those kinds of things. And then, you know, irrigation is different and those kinds of things. So going into it, we felt like that we had this opportunity to experiment with using permaculture techniques and edible forest gardening in particular to show that we could grow at least enough fruits and greens for our families, enough to eat every day through the growing season with lower maintenance and more diversity and more beauty, actually, than you would get if you just did some row gardening.
And it is beautiful. As it happens, I've seen a video tour of your yard with permaculture promoter Jeff Lawton, and I'll post a link to that in my show blog for listeners. Your place looks fantastic. It's stacked with greenery and food. How long did it take to get an integrated food forest going in your urban yard?
That's usually one of the hardest things for people to wrap their brains around. It's not an immediate return. It's a wait-and-see perspective. So we like to think of it as a kind of a phase of a process, and we kind of have termed it sleep, creep, reap, and then leap. So in the book, we talk about how the perennial system is you can produce some products and foods in the early stages, but you really kind of, it's a short-term investment for a long-term gain. And so we spread the budgeting out over the first 3 to 5 years. And then now in the 10th year, we're really reaping and things are leaping like crazy. We feel like we're probably getting close to 80% of our fruit and fresh greens in terms of feeding the families during the growing season. And Eric likes to joke that until our greenhouse got crushed by a tree a couple of years ago in a winter storm, it was 10 years before he had to ever go to the supermarket during the winter to get greens. So we've had some successes here, and we feel like a little bit of wait and see is a good strategy with this kind of design process.
I was surprised to see giant banana plants growing in New England. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. That's kind of a fun thing we've been doing since the first day. It's a combination of kind of putting a front to our project that shows the neighborhood that we want to show some beauty about what we're doing and kind of an interest. It also is culturally appropriate, where there is a Puerto Rican heritage families in the neighborhood, and we grow the banana trees not for fruit, but to show that you can grow the leaves of bananas to use as pasteles, which is like a tamale that Puerto Rican folks cook and eat, a traditional food. And so a combination of beauty, interest, and actual use with them. And it's just nice, you know, in the summer, we can look out our window to the porch and see the bananas blowing in the wind, and it kind of makes us think we're in the tropics.
And I'm guessing you're not growing much during this cold snap they're calling the Arctic Vortex. Will your plants survive this punishing cold, and can you give us any tips for protecting things in a northern climate?
Sure. I could even start with the bananas. They're supposed to be hardy to a growing zone 6, which is about negative 10 degrees Fahrenheit as the coldest temperature, a minimum temperature. So in the last 10 years, we've only had one of the clumps of the bananas die, and that's with very little protection, maybe some mulch on top. It'll be interesting to see this year. It has been very cold for us, for some of our plants. One strategy, though, is there's various reasons why we grow the plants we do, but in terms of hardiness, we like to look for plants that either we know are hardy to really cold temperatures or are native, so they're already adapted to these conditions. Or we, in a lot of cases, will experiment with things outside our zone and, you know, maybe zone 6 or even zone 7, just to really prove to ourselves and the networks, the botanical networks that we're a part of, that, you know, it depends on the microclimates you're growing and it depends on where you actually are in those growing zones. And we can really push this a little bit, I think. We don't have to grow plants and keep them in what the books tell us, because plants don't read books.
Jonathan Bates, one development of your story really pleased me. You found several ways to make a living as you practice permaculture. People put down this idea, well, you shouldn't be commercial, but people have to make a living. So tell us how Food Forest Farm Permaculture Nursery grew out of your project.
Sure. It kind of grew organically, so to speak. I didn't really grow up and get into my careers thinking I was going to be a nurseryman. But really, what one thing is nice about the way we do things here now, and we try to really live our lives in a way that meets some of the permaculture ethics and principles, is a lot of times if you plan and design well and have good thinking, the process as you go along will show you things you wouldn't have necessarily seen. Like, for example, when we did the design for the garden, the permaculture design process, really the landscape helps us design the garden. We don't try to impose our beliefs or thinking so much other than our goals. We do the same thing for our life now, too. And what happened, we've noticed in the beginning days of the project, that by about the third or fourth year, these perennial systems started to really reproduce and had a lot of baby plants and seeds that were being produced. You know, they actually, in some cases, became a problem. They became weeds, quote unquote. And we said, okay, well, we could either get rid of them and throw them out or compost them, or maybe they're actually, this problem can be turned into a solution. And what we did was the visitors and the friends that came and visited us, people interested in our garden, we started giving them away and showing people this is what it's producing, and realized in a very short time that we could actually try to sell them for a little bit of money to help pay for our project. And as it went along, we realized we could sell them for as much as $10 a piece. People were really interested in these kind of rare and interesting and useful plants that aren't very available. So that eventually evolved to us and me realizing, after a couple of years as a hobbyist playing around with these ideas, that this could actually be a viable business. And right now, I'd say maybe about a third of the income for our family depends on this business, and we're actually moving toward possibly more than half or all of our income coming from not only the nursery, but we do also educational services like speaking events and presentations and tours and consultations as part of the business.
Really, you're spreading the seeds of your own ideas to other people's land and gardens. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. My guest is New England small-scale grower and permaculturalist Jonathan Bates. Do you have any tips for us about labor-saving techniques or tools that you discovered along the way?
Sure. Other than doing a good design, which I think is a big part of it, and a lot of experimentation and learning what doesn't work and what works, actual physical tools. One that has become important to us that more and more people are finding out about is the broad fork. There's various models out there, but what we tend to use it for now is we do have a few annual beds. And sometimes I joke is that we grew carrots and beets. We have the vegetables we grew before broad fork and the vegetables we grew after broad fork. And it's an amazing difference. Before broad fork, our carrots would and beets would, you know, split and have multiple bottoms and not grow very well because of hitting the hard pan. Now that we have the broad fork and we loosen the soil and aerate it down as much as 13 inches, we're growing the best carrots we've ever grown. So aeration with tools like a broad fork is really important, we found. And even if you're going to do a perennial permanent system like we've done, it's important to use tools like that to aerate the soil before you even lay down your mulch or your compost to get things set. That's one tool, the broad fork. I think another tool that's been really helpful is the hori hori, which is, it's a hand tool, sort of like a cross between a shovel and a knife. It's very strong and solid steel, and I use it a lot for digging out weeds and also transplanting. Pruners are very important, hand pruners. Felco makes some really great tools for pruning fruit trees and shrubs, and I also use it to propagate a lot for my nursery. And maybe the last physical tool that we use that I really, really find is probably one of my most used tools is a full flat shovel, steel shovel with a steel shank that's a complete piece of steel from the shovel to the handle. And I use a short shovel so that I can kind of stand on it and hold it while I'm pushing it with my feet. It's great. It has a cutting edge at the bottom. And because it's fully steel and really heavy duty, you can use it as a fulcrum to like pull out plants. They have strong roots. You can cut roots with them. And the company I bought from is called King of Spades. They make one of the best products. So that's kind of my little, I don't know, toolkit, literally. But there are some other tools we use that aren't physical. Like we incorporate a lot of volunteerism and help and support from the community. I think that's important. I think doing this on our own wouldn't have been possible. We use various media outlets like the internet and books and speaking engagements to get the word out. That's a really important tool for us. And more we're actually a really important tool is sharing the yield. And right now we don't, you know, other than the nursery, we're not selling food, but our workshops now, we have at least two tastings that people can sign up for. And the tool here is having people taste what we grow. And it turns out it's one of the most effective ways to convince people to do this kind of work.
Right. The proof is in the mouth. Well, tell us just briefly about the Northeast Permaculture Organization.
It's mostly historically been a network. There isn't any formal organization up until recently. It's been slow to develop. There are now either meetup groups and or guilds, as they're called, throughout the Northeast and in pretty much every state, I think except for Connecticut. I think they're starting to form one there, but there isn't one. And there are these groups in Maine. There are groups in New Hampshire, in Vermont, in Massachusetts, in Rhode Island. And in some of these states, there are regional subgroups like northern or southern groups, eastern or western groups. New York is another very active state. For many years, the Northeast Permaculture Network has put on what's called the Permaculture Convergence. It's, I think, either 9 or 10 years old, and I've been involved since the beginning. And it's a state rotational conference, essentially, and every state takes on organizing the next one. The last one was in up near your way. Well, you're west, so it's east, and in Canada. I don't know where the next one's going to be, but if you want to find out more information, a great organization to look up is PINE, Permaculture Institute of the Northeast. And I'm not sure what the website is, but you can search that on the internet and it'll come up. And it's a great resource, and it's becoming kind of an important hub for people to find out what's happening permaculturally in the Northeast.
And there's an intriguing photo on your website of something called a Greenfield Bioshelter. What is that?
It's a new project that I've been working on with the Regenerative Design Group. They're working with me as a subcontractor. And they came to me because we also are now consulting on bioshelters because we have a really successful one in our backyard that we built 2 years ago. And the Greenfield Bioshelter is a client has just started building it, so it's in the build phase. But the idea is it's similar in structure and function to the one that we've built. The one we built in our backyard is 2 years old. It's gone through 2 winters. And essentially what it does with the right design and the right built with the right materials, appropriate materials, you can get quote-unquote, a passive solar greenhouse to keep warm enough to overwinter subtropical plants without any supplemental heat other than the sun. So I don't know how many of your listeners out there have ever been in a passive solar greenhouse, but the idea is the north side's insulated, the south side is your clear side to let in the winter sun, and the sun angle is lower in the winter, so you can really gain a lot of heat if you design it right. And we also add things like water features into the system so that you're collecting the thermal mass and collecting the heat and storing it. The foundation is insulated, so the ground is also a thermal mass. We're doing things like growing citrus and avocados in Massachusetts with a system like this.
It sounds great. You and partner Eric have a book out on perennial vegetables and another one in the works, I gather, on gardening and climate. What can you tell us about those?
Sure, and let me just clarify, Eric is really the main author of our partnership as in this garden. He's written many books, including perennial vegetables. I didn't really have a hand in that other than maybe literally my hand in a picture or something, or maybe my photo or a quote. But the book that we both recently authored together called Paradise Lot, he was the main author and I was a contributor. And essentially that book is really the story of the work we do together in our garden and the work that our families help us with. In that, actually, it's a really good resource if you want to learn about both our histories as people and the work we've done here, and including a lot of the work that Eric's done over the years, including his books. So that's a really great resource if you want to learn more about what we do.
Can you give us any websites or Facebook pages where people can follow up on this?
If you want to learn more about my business, Food Forest Farm, and actually order products from there if you'd like, or just read more about what I do, you can go to foodforestfarm.com. That's a really good resource. Eric's website is perennialsolutions.org, so that's a really great resource you can check out. He also has a website, perennialvegetables.org, so you can check that one out. And the Permaculture Institute of the Northeast, if you want to search for that, that's a really great resource. And both on my website and on Eric's website, we have listings of other great resources. So I would point you to those two pages.
Our guest is Jonathan Bates. He's the owner of Food Forest Farm Nursery and a partner in changing a New England backyard into a food forest in Holyoke, Massachusetts. It was great hearing about this, Jonathan. Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you. You have a good day.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. I got a lot of emails and comments about our last show with permaculture leader David Holmgren and his new essay, Crash on Demand. Some of his longtime followers say David has not changed his basic position. We need to create a permanent culture that does not depend on fossil fuels and is compatible with the long-term survival of all the ecosystems. I wrote to David to clarify whether he was really calling for a mass effort to crash our economic system now. Holmgren has published a condensed version of Crash on Demand, which confirms he is sticking with the original version of permaculture. If enough people leave the industrial death system and it crashes, well, that's just a side effect of doing the right thing, he says. Other listeners question whether such a passive approach can possibly save us from developing climate catastrophe, much less a severe energy crunch. Personally, I don't see permaculture growing fast enough to tip us into survival mode. It will help those involved, including myself, I hope. But it seems the death culture can go on for a long time, consuming the planet even while billions of people opt out or drop off the wealth machine. The minority will still emit more greenhouse gases, kill off more species, drag out more from the sea and the land. The real answer is... Okay, I don't have a good answer for our future. That's why I keep calling up the best people I can find for Radio EcoShock. I am searching for clues, and I hope that is why you keep listening. Lately, our situation feels surreal. All over the web and social media, people call this the Wile E. Coyote moment. It's that impossible time when the coyote has run off the cliff and is still suspended in midair before he plummets into the canyon below. Outside of a tiny conference in December at the Tyndall Institute in Britain, there's practically nothing going on about climate change. The cold winter in North America may persuade people this isn't even a problem, but that same cold means we are burning a record amount of fossil fuels, adding still more to the blanket that will eventually burn us out. It doesn't matter what we think about climate change. It only matters how much we change the atmosphere. It's the same with the economy. Everyone from top bankers, some of them committing suicide lately, to the person in the street who is afraid to invest in the rigged stock markets, everyone knows we are living on borrowed time. The giant Ponzi scheme of debt and derivatives will tumble. We just don't know when. We are living in a time of deep fog. If you have suggestions of people you want me to interview, guests with vision even in darker times, please send me an email. The address is radio@ecoshock.org, radio@ecoshock.org. I value your input, even if I cannot answer each and every email. Your support for Radio EcoShock has been essential. Thank you. Don't forget to educate yourself, to arm yourself with knowledge from our years of past programs, all available as free MP3s from my website, ecoshock.org. One further note, I composed the music for the introduction in this show. My new hobby is combining royalty-free music loops with synthesizer music that I write. We'll head out with another short sample where I completely remix audio with a vocal fragment by Loka called Into the Blue. I'm Alex. See you next week.
Closest friend. Whoa.